The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's R-U-S journal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. And I think today what I want to deal with is Hugo Chavez and Venezuela. And I want to talk about him from a Russian point of view, largely because Chavez has been a key ally of Putin and Russia in Latin America. And Chavez's revolution in Venezuela has been Putin's answer to the American-controlled revolutions in places like Ukraine in 04, excuse me, as well as places like Georgia and elsewhere. And I want to say that Hugo Chavez has done an extraordinary amount of good things for the economy. And I want to say primarily that in the early 1990s, mid-1990s, there was a complete collapse of the economy of Venezuela and a tremendous level of poverty. Back in 89, a guy named Carlos Perez was the pro-IMF president-elect of the country. And not too surprisingly, you know, the main issue that the IMF had relative to Venezuela was to eliminate the social welfare programs. And really ultimately what happened was that you had a lot of very, very angry poor people who had been thrown out of jobs in the 80s and early 90s, as well as a massive debt in a country that is extremely wealthy in terms of its natural resources. So Venezuela is one of these places in the early 90s that is absolutely ripe for revolution. And Chavez is elected in 1998. Chavez is a military man, is a paratrooper, is a true patriot and a true nationalist in the best sense of the word. And he's elected in the late 90s, in 1998, as the opponent of the oligarchy. He views Venezuela as a Western colony, as an American colony, as a colony controlled by a handful of local oligarchs. He also has a problem with the fact that in the late 90s there are low oil prices, and oil, of course, is one of Venezuela's main areas of hard cash foreign currency. One of the things that Chavez does is he stops privatization. He will not permit any more Venezuelan enterprises to be privatized, because privatization really means not coming into the control of those who believe in the free market. That's never been the case, not in Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, or anywhere else. Privatization means that these companies, these strategic companies, come into the hands of those who are backed by foreign powers, or foreign powers actually directly. So he stops privatization, Lukashenko stops privatization, and what you have in different parts of the world, in Belarus and Venezuela, is an increase in economic production and a lowering of unemployment. In 1999, Chavez asks for a new constitution, and he is elected, and his new constitution is elected in a referendum. And essentially what Chavez is doing in the late 90s is that he wants a new Latin American deal for the poor. And this is something that he's very good at, and that in fact he has created an economic powerhouse in the area without forgetting about the poorest of citizens. And of course, no surprise, he's elected again in 2000. He gives the poor their land. And this is something that it seems awfully simple, but of course never really is in reality. The idea of land reform is always something full of legal tangles and everything else, but he wants to begin his reign in 99-2000 by giving a brand new healthcare system, as well as redistributing land to those who really want to till it. That is to say, those poor folk who have the ability and have the desire to till the land, as much land as they could possibly till, and more if they need it, if they require it over the years. And of course, he also demands free education for everybody. There is in 2002 a George Bush controlled coup attempt. This is a coup attempt very similar to that which you have seen in attempts that you've seen in Lebanon and Syria and Georgia and Russia and Belarus and everywhere else. It's another one of these areas of regime change by the U.S. government. And 2002 sees the so-called Enabling Act from Chavez, which is largely popular, I think, by the masses of the people, where he could rule by decree. Now, ruling by decree was no problem in Russia when Yeltsin did it with IMF money. It suddenly becomes a problem when Chavez does it against American corporate interests in Venezuela in 2002. So I want to say several things. Hugo Chavez is a Venezuelan patriot and nationalist. He is a military man elected twice to the presidency, and he wants to see a strong agrarian distributivist, not a socialist, but it shows you how stupid American conservatives are. American conservatives are the stupidest people that I have ever come across, ever in my life, and I've come across a lot of people. American conservatives are stupid. They should be ignored. If not ignored, at least punched out. Please do that for me. The American conservatives are so stupid that they don't realize the distinction between distributivism and socialism. Chavez comes to control Venezuela with a distributivist and, quite frankly, very Catholic idea, that those who control the land, those who till the land, those who plant the land, those who know the land, should be those who own the land. Somehow, this irritated the neocons who controlled Washington, D.C. between 2000 and 2002, as well as most of the Protestant churches. And as a result of this, they demanded that Hugo Chavez be killed. This was the case in the Bush White House. This was the case with Pat Robertson and a whole bunch of these other weirdo heretic freaks. And the fact is that Hugo Chavez, dealing with these struggles, had to retreat and do what Yeltsin did under American control and insist on rule by decree. Okay. All right, let me deal with the question of Hugo Chavez and the new constitution. Now, Hugo Chavez is not a stupid guy. Hugo Chavez is very much an equal to people like Islamov or Putin or Kravchuk or Lukashenko. He is, or Assad for that matter. He is a man of honor and of virtue. And we know how problematic it might be in dealing with these things, political things from an urban point of view, but Chavez made the most of it. Let me tell you a little bit about what Chavez wanted in terms of land redistribution. The new constitution, in more modern times, he really hated the idea, as do I, of course, and as does any rational person, of land, productive agricultural land, as something that should be the subject of speculative investments. Chavez rejected that point of view. Any estate in Venezuela that was idle, that was owned by somebody, but that owner was absentee or that was not tilling the land at the time, that these estates were now illegal and forfeit, and as a result were given to anybody who was willing to invest in it. Invest in it in the true sense of the word, to work it, to till it, to seed it, to weed it, to do whatever, well, you know, all the work that was that's necessary to take care of it. Now, this is a basic idea. Any land that can produce food that is not being tilled should be tilled by those people who have the wherewithal to do it. Somehow this angered both the Bush administration as well as the Protestant churches in America. Even more than this, Chavez wanted tax incentives to be included in the Venezuelan tax system and tax enforcement, that idle land be taken over by those who knew what they were doing, that idle land should be taken over by those who not only knew how to till, but were willing to own the land as perpetual owners. So you wouldn't have these huge these acreages that were just abandoned by super wealthy owners and drug dealers in America and Europe and elsewhere. Chavez demanded and in fact enacted into law that these lands should be farmed and the profits taken by those peasants who had the ability to do it. And as a result, he received the anger, including death threats, from both the Protestant churches in America and the American government. And that the state, the Venezuelan government under Chavez, will be exactly the one that is the guarantor of ownership of anyone who can prove that they can produce good, necessary food and fuel from the land. And that this kind of development is the most sustainable. This is a development that has no problem in terms of environmental degradation or anything else, because this is the peasant economy. And what Chavez wanted, and this is why you have these suburban conservative morons, these pseudo-Christian fake suburban half-witted almost subhuman scumbags talking about Venezuela like they know something. In their cubicle jockey jobs, they're going to be talking about how land should be redistributed. But Caracas under Chavez wanted to see a holistic revitalization of the rural area. But what that means from the point of view of Venezuela is that Land O'Lakes and Archer Daniels Midland cannot come into Venezuela and buy up the land and control it like a factory. So suddenly conservatives under the control of these institutions got very angry that people like Chavez wanted to train even urban people to go to the land and learn how to farm and learn how to be self-sufficient and to create self-sufficient farming communities. Our friends in Washington, D.C. got extremely angry at this. And somehow the opposition, saturated with American money, developed the idea that land that was controlled by private owners, even if it was not being tilled, was off limits. And this is something that got Chavez outraged. That if land is being held as private property, even though it's producing nothing, it should be protected by the state of Venezuela. This is something that Chavez got extremely angry about. So this is what Hugo Chavez does in response to this kind of nonsense. He says that any Venezuelan citizen who is the head of household and that is between 18 and 25 years old, may apply for a grant of land. The grant will be given. It is zero cost, but it cannot be sold. That is to say that what Venezuela is trying to do is to create a republic of distributivist private property landholders. This is what's happening. This is the nature of democratic socialism. It is a very positive agrarian idea where private property for heads of household, especially young heads of household, are protected against the control of large corporations. And that people like Chavez, what they want to see is land ownership, health care, and education. And I want to say that in this particular period of time, between 1998 and 2004, you have a lowering of infant mortality by 18%, almost 20%, almost a fifth of the infant mortality in this country, and these pro-life Protestant morons are talking about overthrowing Chavez. And what you have is this massive increase in economic growth. And then, you know, he wants to protect the world of the native Venezuelans, of the Indians of that area, and to have them be as self-sufficient as humanly possible. He wants food to be subsidized. He wants construction to be subsidized so that small owners may be given the liquidity necessary to continue to work. And by the time he's in office, by a few years, you have 100,000 agricultural cooperatives, and these are controlled by the ordinary farmer. The income of the poorest people in Venezuela, the first few, you know, 5-7 years of Chavez's rule is about 150%. Between 2003 and 2006, it is even higher. That he cuts the percentage of people under the poverty line by 2002 by 48%. And yet the churches in America are screaming that Chavez needs to be killed. No wonder there's so many atheists in the world. If they understood the true orthodox understanding of agrarianism, they wouldn't be atheists, and they wouldn't be viewing the church leadership as the corrupt, subhuman, demonic, Satan-worshipping group of slime bags that they truly are. 44% of the budget in Venezuela in 2005 is to be dedicated to agricultural investment for small, poor, and middle-class investors. This is what got the Americans so upset. This is what got Pat Robertson so upset in George Bush. This is what's going on. This is what the conservative neo-lib, neo-con movement is really all about. It's about oligarchy. If you want to talk about Satanism, I don't want to hear about Satanism unless it's connected with oligarchy, the domination of a few trillionaires over everything. And you know what? 2006, Hugo Chavez freaks out the American establishment by passing the communal council law. The communal council law means that all municipal communes and conciliar governments have full power to dictate over where federal money is being spent. This is why Pat Robertson and his Masonic Satan-worshipping sleazebags wanted to kill Chavez. This is why. He subsidized heating oil for the poor people. And you know what? Outside of the oil industry, excluding the oil industry, the Venezuelan economy grew by 10% every year. That's higher than China. And like Russia under Putin, Chavez paid all IMF debts off ahead of schedule. That's what's going on in Latin America. That's the nature of the Chavez rule in Venezuela. And this is why the Americans are so upset. This is why the Protestants are so upset. This is why the so-called mindless, half-witted conservatives are so upset. But this is the nature of national socialism in the best sense of the word. This is the socialist economics based on nationalist moral principles. This is what happens. The poor do better, the middle class do better, and the rich have to, for once in their lives, have to pay. And Caracas, of course, sees the Americans as the worshipers of Satan. And I think you may have known that Hugo Chavez, when he addressed the United Nations, blessed himself because he smelled the stench of sulfur after George Bush had spoken. He saw Satan's footprints in the UN before he spoke. And you know, this is a man that was more or less secular before coming to the United Nations, but by the time he comes there, he's not secular anymore. He sees Satan, he sees George Bush, he sees the United States, he sees the evil empire functioning, the shadow image of the Soviet Union, which is the United States right now. Anyway, we will continue this discussion, although on very different terms, when we return. Hang in there, my friends. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back. I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. In the beginning, we were talking about Venezuela, and now I want to talk about Syria. Venezuela and Syria have a lot in common. They are both anti-Zionist and pro-Russian. And I want to talk a little bit about the nature of the economic reforms under General Assad, whose son is now currently controlling Syria. So I want to talk about Syria in the 80s and 90s and what the nature of this society was from an economic point of view. And I want to say that they have a lot in common. They have a lot in common in the sense that they are violently anti-Zionist. The United States has tried to trip up their growth as much as humanly possible. And yet their economic programs in both countries have worked to a great extent. Like Venezuela, the Syrian social nationalist movement under Assad sought to redistribute the land to those who wanted to till it and who wanted to make some kind of a profit off of it. And given the nature of the fact that both states came under the violent assault of the American-Israeli nexus, they were forced into a posture where the state had to lead the nature of the economic and social growth of the country. In the Syrian case, as well as in the Venezuelan case, what the state wanted was a strong, loyal, small-holding peasant sector. So in both cases, they are attempting, Syria in the 70s, Venezuela in this decade, to create a distributivist, small-holding, loyal peasant class. And in both cases, they wanted a policy of import substitution. That is to say, instead of the short-term desire for imports from other countries that might be better quality and cheaper, the state will invest in making native producers as efficient, as high quality, and as low cost as the foreign manufacturers. The import substitution, as problematic as it can be from an economic point of view, import substitution is very much a long-term concept which seeks to protect native industries until they could reach a level at which they will be able to compete with everybody else, or at the very least, that they will be able to provide the local population with goods at fairly low cost. At the same time, the Syrian government created agricultural and productive cooperatives, and that these were essentially transit points for state aid in terms of building this distributivist, localist concept of smallholders in agriculture and indeed manufacturing. And they permitted under Assad private/state joint ventures. They permitted both local bourgeoisie as well as foreign bourgeoisie to be able to come into the country and to invest, but only so long as the state was in fact involved in this. And the only real problem, and you saw substantial economic growth under these circumstances, the problems were most of all bureaucratic. And I want to say that the main problem with these bureaucratic issues were the fact that these government officials were paid very low salaries and they were trained very poorly. But this is very typical of a third world state struggling to create a modern economy. So this is nothing that can be put at the feet of the Assad government, or even the Venezuelan government or the Belarusian government or any other government that is trying to build an economy outside of the New World Order. In the 1990s, there was a great degree of drought in Syria, which hurt the economic cooperatives and the agricultural cooperatives. There was a tremendous growth in the middle class and bourgeoisie in Syria in the 80s. Because of these kind of programs. So there was a sense of a controlled liberalization, but a controlled liberalization that would make certain that the Syrian state, and therefore Syrian, the security interests of the government would remain at the forefront. By the early 80s in Syria, what you had continually was the problem of proletarianization of the smallholders. And you had the proletariat in the agricultural world remaining. And that is to say, these either landless peasants or peasants whose land holdings were so small that they really couldn't do much of anything. That the smallholder economy made up about 62%, 65% of the production of the country should tell you something. It's a very positive idea that the middling to low peasants still were economically dominant in Syria by the early 90s is still immensely important. And like it or not, the cooperative program coming from the military government of Assad helped stabilize and give incentives to the middle class peasants to continue their movement outward, continue their movement to increase investment and risk. And you had the idea of the cooperatives controlled by the state. You had this idea that it in fact stabilized the smallholders and rescued them both from becoming part of the oligarchy on the one hand, as well as falling into proletarianization on the other hand. And so no matter what you did throughout the 80s and 90s, even with the drought that the Syrian government had to deal with, unfortunately a part of that part of the world, you had a substantial increase in production. And what the Assad government and the Ba'ath government in Syria has to its credit is the small peasant capitalism that it created. Now, small peasant peoples do not create capitalism. They create a highly efficient free market. And that's something that these cooperative state-owned programs had to create in the 80s and 90s. And really, you know, the problem is that in terms of its industry, what you had was political cliques that controlled the industry of the society, and yet, on the other hand, you had small peasant farmers who controlled the world of food production. And so, but within industry, what you really had was a great degree of turnover and an unmotivated labor force. And yet, when you go into the countryside in Syria in the 80s and 90s, what you had was a great, rather tremendous degree of motivated small capitalists, small enterprises that were encouraged by the government everywhere. So in the 1970s, you had substantial economic expansion, 3.7% per capita every year from 70 to 75, 8.2%, 77 to 80, almost 7%. So you had substantial increases in this period of time. And the industry also, with some Soviet help at the time, was also greatly diversified. The problem, of course, was the need for external resources and dependency, and that this had a tendency to fuel inflation in the 80s and 90s, and there was a tremendous debt to the USSR through this period of time. In the early 90s, you had a great degree of inflation making matters more difficult. In this era, you also had a huge military budget that needed to be maintained because of the threat of the American-Israeli combine. So, under Assad in his last years, what you really had was a withdrawal of the state from the economy with the understanding that the peasant leaders of economic investment would take over, and hopefully we would disinvest or divest ourselves of the political cliques that controlled industry. And so that was the nature of the Syrian economy from the late 70s to the 90s. So what I want to say as far as the Syrian economic idea is concerned, I want to make a few general points. In the 1960s, you had the nationalization approach to the economy in hopes that foreign sources will be eliminated from economic life. That in 1965, the largest enterprises were nationalized in the Syrian world, and that banks in particular were brought under national control. That between 1963 and 1965, the social nationalist government of the country sought to break the merchant landowner class of the economy. And yet, when Hafiz al-Assad, the general in the Air Force, was to take over, he is an agrarian, but he is a pragmatist. And, you know, in the 1970s, where a lot of this was going on, you had a GDP growth of 10% every year, something that drove the Israelis crazy. So you have a 20% increase in the percentage of the GDP that was dedicated to industry between 1940 and 1980, and I want to say that textiles, sugar, cement, small business is really at the center of all of this. And thanks to the recent findings of oil in the northern part of the country on the Turkish border. Syria is now, it has gone largely from an oil-less part of the Middle East to now a country self-sufficient in oil. It is also self-sufficient in school, in education and schools, as well as the mercantile sector. So the Ba'athist social nationalist idea has worked very much in Syria relative to the third world position that Syria found itself in the 50s and 60s. The military government under Hafiz al-Assad brought infrastructure to what is without doubt an enviable level for the third world, and that the increase in peasant proprietorship has largely based itself around cotton, beets for sugar in particular, as well as beans. And this has been a major supplier of food and sugar throughout the Middle East. And so now, I guess even by the late 70s, two-fifths of the GDP has been put into private hands, but private hands that are loyal to the social nationalist idea. And that the military government and the social nationalist idea have been have insisted that absentee landlords sell their estates, and that all estates that are abandoned should be controlled by those who till the land. So I might say that those who created this policy in Venezuela, in fact, took from Africa and even Syria this idea of eliminating the absentee landlords and landlords who controlled land that could be productive, but since they owned it and wouldn't let anyone work on it, the state took this over and brought others under its control. So 3.7 million acres by the 1970s were expropriated by the state and then given to those farmers who were capable of controlling it. The 1960s, the Ba'ath Party takes over, very different from the Iraqi Ba'ath Party, and they demand a strong state sector both in agriculture and in manufacturing, but to create the concept of the cooperative farm. So, in summary, both in terms of agriculture and in manufacturing, Syria, a country with very little in terms of natural resources, thanks to the social nationalist idea, has been brought to almost second world status as far as the old Soviet Union is concerned, and has created a relatively powerful economy, both in agriculture and in manufacturing, as well as in foodstuffs, to put up a strong nationalist link against the Israeli-American combine. It's very, very difficult, I think, for the United States to push Syria around, as well as Venezuela around, for this reason. So, what has this been all about? What I've been trying to do here is to compare and to give a sense of the vision of what a third world social nationalist approach to economics can bring to the developing world. You know, when I became 20 years ago, practically today, when I became a specialist in social theory, I decided that one of my big areas was going to be the developing world, whether it be agricultural America or the traditional third world in world politics. I wanted to really specialize in those systems that gave the most to the middle, lower middle, and poorer parts of the national population. And so Syria and Venezuela, as I talk today in 2010, given the circumstances and given the enemies and given the natural resources of the societies, Syria and Venezuela, under a strong social nationalist populist government, have done more or less okay. Both Venezuela and Syria have been feted by the Russian government and have been used for a very long time, for better or for worse, and I think for the better, to fight the New World Order. And that Syria and Venezuela are two linchpins in the developing world, one in the Middle East, of course, the other in Latin America, to build a coalition against the New World Order. The Soviets looked to Syria in 1956, probably the most serious at any time, that the loss of Egypt really to the Israeli alliance brought the Soviet Union to Syria to a greater extent than it would have ever been. And that the weakness of the Egyptian, really the Arab movement, brought the Soviet Union to back Syria. But the Syrians were very upset that in 1982 there was very little Soviet help against the Israelis. And that after the death of Brezhnev, that there was a great degree of worry about Syrian loyalty to the Soviet Union, and making matters even worse, that there was this great problem of Syrian loyalty to the USSR after the debacle in Afghanistan. That Syria really was a linchpin. I want to say the same about Iraq under Saddam Hussein, that the Ba'ath Party really sought a balance in the Levant between the Soviet Union, the United States, Europe, East Asia, that the balance could be drawn in the Levant, in the Middle East, and that places like Libya, Egypt, Syria, Iraq could be left alone if they were to work one part of the Cold War against another. The Syrians, I guess, were convinced in the 1970s and early 80s that the Soviets would respond to an Israeli strike on Syria or Iraq. And by 87, you know, the Syrians owed about $15 billion to the USSR. Some of you may have heard me talk about this before, but to a great extent, that's largely been forgiven. But the Soviets had invested very heavily in the Syrian economy, and had really kind of sought to bring the Syrian economy under Soviet control. The problems are the following in terms of Syria: that number one, the economy could never really meet the demands of the defense requirements of the country. Even though Syria had a great degree of growth both in industry and in agriculture, it could not pay for what it required from the USSR and elsewhere in terms of dealing with the Israelis. That the Syrians were very dependent on advanced economies and at the same time had a great degree of population growth. Even though in 70s to 90s, you had a great degree of emphasis in terms of public money on education and technical training, in terms of its higher education idea. And you know, what you have in Syria under the Ba'ath system since the 1960s is really an 8 to a 12% increase in growth on average. GDP year on year really shows a great success in the social nationalist economy of Syria, even though you had quite a bit of Soviet aid in the process. Hafez al-Assad wanted to see a revitalization of small-scale private enterprise. And the same thing goes with Chavez. The free market is okay so long as a free market doesn't mean the complete destruction of the ruling class. And it's given over to the bourgeoisie. The military bureaucratic establishment wants to maintain itself and yet still support a small-scale bourgeois movement. And I want to say that in the early 80s, you had in Syria an 8.1% growth of GDP on average year on year. And the value of agricultural production has increased since the Ba'ath government has taken over by over 300%. And in the 80s, saw some oil opened. And I guess one of the big problems is in the 80s is that the Iraqis cut the transit fees coming from Iraq through Syria up into Turkey to Europe cut these substantially in the 1980s. And actually, the oil from Iraq via Syria through Lebanon and Turkey into Europe, that's actually a major source of foreign currency for the Syrian government. And I want to say that the social nationalist movement saw industry as a means of gaining economic independence, and really its infrastructure and transport comes from the Eastern Bloc throughout the 70s and 1980s. So I think I've given you here a general sense of what the Syrian and Venezuelan mentality was economically throughout the 80s and 90s. I guess, you know, you had a certain sense of, you know, Richard Nixon wanted to go to Assad to make friends with him. And the Syrian interest in Lebanon, which comes up quite a bit, has to do with the culture of Greater Syria to support the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. To worry about Israeli incursions onto the Syrian border, and it did end fighting in Lebanon in the 1980s and 90s. It did want to fight Islamic extremism in Lebanon in the 80s and 90s, and really create, I guess, a kind of a balance among forces in Lebanon. And so this is really what motivated Syrian attacks on Lebanon in the 80s and 90s. And I want to make it very clear that General Assad, a man who I admire, the defender of the Orthodox Church in the Greek Church in Syria, did view the PLO as the creation of the CIA. And this is why Assad had no problem with the PLO being taken to Libya, really under Israeli auspices. After the Lebanon wars in the 80s and 90s, largely because Assad didn't take the PLO very seriously as an anti-Israeli force. It took the PLO as a creation of the CIA, and the move to Libya and to North Africa, Assad took as evidence of the support of the CIA for the PLO to create a controlled opposition to the Israeli regime. So anyway, I think what I've done here is attempt to create some kind of parallel between the Syrian and Venezuelan economies, the ideas of social nationalism, and the ideas of creating an economy in the face of the New World Order. And I hope I've succeeded in doing this, and I appreciate everybody who has helped me do this, all of my friends as well as my opponents. And my opponents, you know, if they attack me intelligently, what they force me to do is to go back to my sources and to kind of retool my mentality. And this is why that the screaming and yelling of so many of the of these bloggers, these idiots, these halfwits, really doesn't mean anything. What really matters is to force a radio host or a writer to go back and to review his sources to see if, in fact, he is telling the truth. If you can do that, then you have done quite a bit of work for the person in question. So I want to thank my opponents as well as my friends. I want to thank Mike and Steve and Dietrich and everyone who's helped me with this radio program. I want to thank them for their work on my behalf, and I appreciate everything that they have done. And may God bless them, and I'll talk to you guys next time. Hang in there, my friends.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to